This is Crossroads, a Get Religion podcast.
The New York Times headline, Covington students did not instigate Lincoln Memorial encounter, Bishop says. In a culture, especially a media culture of hot takes, this probably goes down as one of the, what shall we say, half-baked hot takes. Not only did the bishop pounce on the Covington students shortly after the Lincoln Memorial encounter, as the New York Times calls it, but after some consideration, after some more videos came out, the bishop decided they needed an investigation, and now he has pronounced this, or exonerated the students of instigating an incident at the Lincoln Memorial that I still don't completely understand what was happening there. That tells you something about perhaps how the media coverage has proceeded on this story. Greetings and welcome to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Who has more to learn from this incident at this point, journalists or church leaders?
Okay, I'm going to describe this as kind of a three-step process. I think journalists had a lot to learn initially, just from the simple fact that this is, gosh, can you think of a better example of coverage being driven by a quick shot, heavily edited activist video? People just took the bait and ran with it. So we should have learned a lot as journalists about that. We should have, at the very least, have learned that in an age of smartphones, there are probably going to be other videos that surface, and you might want to try to contact some of the other obvious people and try to see if there's any other video out there. Now, in this case, that was complicated because the young people and their chaperones got on a bus and proceeded back to Kentucky, and unless you had their cell phones, there was no way to call them. But still, you get my point here. I'm talking more about journalism basics. The second group of people, the second stage of this thing to me, is that I really hope the leaders of the March for Life and similar abortion marches, pro-life marches, all kinds of things surrounding this issue, I sure hope that pro-life leaders kind of got a big hint from this thing that it's time to take the heat down on partisan politics related to these events. Now, maybe it's just me, but I would be perfectly fine with politicians who choose to come out and march. Maybe congresspersons or stuff like that would come out, actually take part and march, the occasional senator. But in terms of who gets up there on that stage and makes remarks, even though this year's remarks included Democrats who were pro-life, that's not who's going to get on the news. I wish we would tone down the partisan politics. Now, then that also factors in to a secondary issue. Now, one of the most interesting things that's come out here in the last couple of days in terms of a private investigation that was done of this event is the investigators dug out that during previous years, Covington Catholic high school students have purchased kind of whatever hats are being sold, you know, on the National Mall as souvenirs, and they came home with Barack Obama Hope hats. This year, most of the hats being sold are the bright red trigger warning Donald Trump hats, the Make America Great Again hats. I think that before you put your students on the bus, you even tell them there are going to be people with smartphones, there are going to be reporters, let's be careful out there. Let's remember why we're here, and let's try to keep politics out of this. So you've got the people taking students and other groups on the march, and then also mercy. I hope that if something like this does happen, there were some Catholic leaders who really, really need to take the lesson from this, that they might want to cut their own people a little bit of slack until they have seen more video. Let's come back to the church leaders here again later. The third level of this whole thing to me is going to take time to unfold. And that is, frankly, journalists have a tremendous amount of protection in America when it comes to libel and defamation, and I am very happy about that. Yet most of those rules are framed to protect the press when they're covering people who have a reason to be in the public eye, public officials, celebrities, superstar clergy. You know, you've got more leeway to make mistakes when you're going after people who are in the public eye. Now, you can make really horrible mistakes and still get nabbed. In this case, we were talking about an event that centered on coverage of children. Now, if somebody, there's been rumblings of papers being served to a lot of journalists, even to Catholic leaders and others, in terms of whether or not to sue, kind of exploratory papers linked to libel, defamation, etc. I think it will be interesting to see if any of this gets in front of a jury, specifically a jury, not a judge, a jury. I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens on two issues. One, what happens when you say these kinds of things about children? Isn't that a face you want to punch out? Says people with massive amounts of power in the mainstream media and in Hollywood, that sort of comment being made. The second thing is, I really don't know if we have a definitive case in the smartphone era on what is considered good faith research. It's very important in a lawsuit on a topic like this that journalists be able to show that they, yes, we made a mistake. Gosh, we wish we hadn't done this. But here are the steps we went through. We tried to get information from the other side. We made a good faith effort to confirm the facts. Well, that was one thing in the age of taking notes, having cassette recorders, and using telephones. What is a good faith effort to confirm facts in the age of smartphones? I mean, if you go with a story from an edited video from a group that is clearly considered an activist group, is a jury going to expect you to try to find information on the other side of that? Or can you just go straight onto the airwaves and straight onto the internet with information just from one side and kind of damn the torpedoes full speed ahead? So that's three levels. The initial journalism response, the second, what church leaders should learn from this, and the third, it may take a while to find out what the legal fallout is here for journalists. But I think if this ends up in front of a jury, that's going to be very interesting.
We're kind of talking about the coverage that appeared in both Washington Post and the New York Times, but you say that the New York Times contained a phrase that got under your saddle a little bit. What was it?
Well, first of all, we're talking about this private investigation. The original reports, I couldn't figure out from several of the stories exactly who hired the private investigators. The New York Times today, right up front, in the first sentence says, the Roman Catholic Bishop of Covington, Kentucky, released an investigative report. It's very important, if you're going to put the bishop up there as the origin of the information, it's very important that you go on and note that it was a major private investigative agency that does all kinds of work in this site and that they hired them to do an independent investigation. How independent is that when you've kind of been hired by the Catholic Church? I don't know, but it's interesting in this case. The Catholic Church wants to know the facts, too, in case it ends up on trial for some of these remarks. No, the phrase that jumped out at me in the New York Times story, it just made me laugh out loud, but you know, I'm glad I wasn't drinking a beverage at that point that I could have spewed on my computer screen. It talked about lots of people had condemned the Covington High School students, da-da-da-da-da, and then here's the sentence that got me. But within a day, longer videos began to circulate that showed a more complicated scene at the memorial, comma, and supporters of President Trump rallied to their side. It's the second half of that sentence that just absolutely cracked me up. Yeah, the only people who were upset about this story were supporters of President Trump. That's who jumped onto Twitter. That's who jumped online and began to say that this was a major journalism problem. That's who began to circulate all the other videos. Once again, I mean, does the press have to make everything primarily about Donald Trump? I know the red hats were there, the MAGA hats or whatever you want to call those trigger warning devices. But, I mean, come on. This was way bigger than supporters of President Trump criticizing the press coverage. I don't think we would put Andrew Sullivan, who wrote one of the most brutal, blunt pieces on the press coverage of this, I don't think we would automatically put Andrew Sullivan, one of the world's best known gay rights activists and journalists, I don't think we would put him immediately in the camp of President Trump supporters, you think?
I'm wondering, Terry, if that phrase after the comma, they could have ended it with a period right there. It would have been perfectly factual. If that phrase was there because in the newsroom at the New York Times, the bigger story here is that the press got a black eye.
Well, I mean, I think that is the huge story. There are still people who haven't walked back a lot of their remarks. But part of what offended me so much about the phrase and supporters of President Trump rallied to their side, part of what offended me about that was that across the journalistic community, there really was a quite diverse and balanced cry of outrage about this coverage and saying we really need to learn from this. We need to learn some reporting methods in the age of quick video. It was more than second guessing. Some of it was repentance, and that wasn't linked to Donald Trump. That was linked to what does it say when you've got people signing onto Twitter talking about a teenage boy's face and saying, gosh, don't you want to punch his lights out? Now, you can say that's a rhetorical device and just playing and going too far, but still, there was some wild stuff in social media and in major elite media press reports. And I sure hope a wide, diverse spectrum of journalists are thinking about this and thinking about how this affects their futures and how they do their work.
I guess what I'm wondering about, and you had mentioned this before, is where was the other end of the story? The last time we talked about the March for Life, you had mentioned that one of the activists that was involved in this altercation at the Lincoln Memorial, I believe the next day, appeared at a Catholic church during Mass time. And that story, I haven't seen it any place. I haven't looked that hard, but the guy's making the news every place. He's granting interviews. I haven't seen him in connection with that one.
Well, it's interesting that in the new piece in the New York Times, Phillips is not available to be interviewed. I think that there are lawyers who have now stepped in on that. But you're right. I mean, not that day, but later, within a day or so, there was a mass going on at the Basilica of the Immaculate Conception. We've talked about this before, I believe, and I've written about it at Get Religion. And activists showed up. They held a rally pretty far out. I've seen videos of that, pretty far away from the Basilica. But then they went up to the Basilica, and there are videos that show that Phillips was there, then Nathan Phillips, the Native American activist with the drum. So there they were with their drums, playing their drums, and they march up to the Basilica. And apparently an effort was made to go inside the basilica during the Mass. Now, was that with the intention of playing the drums and disrupting the Mass, marching down the center aisle, doing... We don't know, because security managed to prevent them from doing that. Okay, let's play mirror image here. Do you think there would have been more coverage if a bunch of pro-lifers in Donald Trump hats had decided to disturb a gay rights service at an Episcopal church within a day or two?
Wall to wall.
Yeah. I still don't know why. I mean, as someone who lived and worked in the Washington, D.C. area for quite a long time, we're talking about the Basilica of the U.S. Catholic Bishops, arguably the most important Roman Catholic sanctuary in the United States. You could not pick a more symbolic location to have had the second act of this drama. I have looked and looked and looked, and for some reason, listeners, I'm making shock scare quote marks in the air with my fingers. For some reason, this was another one of those conservative media stories. It wasn't worth attention elsewhere. And I still can't believe that's the case, and I hope journalists think about that too, but I have some doubts about that one.
What do you make of the bishop's insinuation that his initial reaction to the viral videos that were coming out at the March for Life was to blame the students, and that he insinuated that he was bullied into making that reaction?
Isn't that a fascinating word? Who is in a position to bully a bishop under those circumstances? I can only assume one of two things, and this is one of those things where it could be A, B, or C, would be both of the above. That might be a description of having your diocesan switchboard melt down with calls from journalists. You know, what are you going to say? What are you going to say? Your kids did this. Your kids did this. Your kids did this. You know, what are you going to say? You could consider that being bullied. I also wonder, since this is kind of a small, out-of-the-way diocese, I would really be interested in knowing whether he also got calls from Catholics, shall we say, who are further up the food chain. Whether or not he either saw reactions on Twitter from major, nationally known Catholic leaders, some of whom who have since pulled their remarks off Twitter. Did he see the kind of progressive wing of the Catholic Church hit boiling point quick and just assume, well, I've got to go along? I mean, this is where the church is going to be on this. Is that what he meant by being bullied? I thought that was fascinating. And at the denominational and church leadership level, I think people in a lot of major denominations should look at that situation and say, well, if we put our students on buses and we send them to Washington for this march, are we ready in case something like this happens again? I think you and I've talked before. I am scared that a lot of Christian schools, Protestant, Catholic, whatever, I am worried that a lot of those schools are now going to think twice about sending busloads full of young people to that march. And if that were to be the case, that would be a particularly sad outcome. And frankly, I think they should think twice about that decision, if that's what they do.
What do you think keeps this story going? You had mentioned earlier the prospect of lawsuits. There have been rumblings from the family of one of the young men who... the smirking young man, we'll just call him. There have been rumblings from his camp that media outlets might be getting a call from their lawyers or perhaps even the diocese.
Oh, there's been more than that. They haven't gotten calls. They've been sent papers. I mean, this is now at kind of an exploratory stage. It would be interesting to see if there are apologies of a more legal nature that emerge from actual talks. You could make some of the actions, you could interpret some of the actions of the local bishop in that manner. I think it would be interesting to see if some media outlets more formally stated apologies in an attempt to head off, you know, any sort of legal action. But like I said before, we're going to learn a lot about journalism in the Twitter and smartphone era if this gets in front of a jury of ordinary Americans somewhere in the heartland. And frankly, as someone who follows this pretty closely, and my wife is a computer-based reference librarian, and she's very interested in law related to the internet as well, I don't think we know the answer to that question yet. I would normally say, gosh, the journalists are going to win hands down under any sort of circumstance at a big public event of this kind. There are factors about this one that make me say, I'm not sure what's going to happen in front of a jury on this one.
What are those factors?
Well, it's what I said earlier. It's this thing about how you report and how you show that you attempted to verify the facts, that you weren't just firing off half-cocked, that you didn't handle this in an unprofessional manner. You know, there are going to be, if this thing ends up in front of a jury, there are going to be people standing there with phone records saying, we made the following phone calls to the school, we made the following attempts, at which point the jury was sitting there saying, yeah, so you based your entire report on an edited activist video? We live in an age where smartphones are everywhere. Can we assume there's other video? Let me flash you back to something else. I have heard from some people saying, well, Mattingly, you really didn't care when it was edited videos of sting operations making Planned Parenthood people talk, right? You sure didn't mind it when those edited videos were cited. Well, first of all, those weren't cited favorably or as truthful in very many mainstream media reports. And second, very quickly, the activist behind that released the entire package of unedited video. And that stood them better when it went further up in courts, that they were willing to show the entire unedited video. Well, in this case, the entire sequence, and particularly the truthfulness of some of the remarks by Nathan Phillips, all of that changed when you saw the unedited video of the entire event. We now have a completely different and much more verified timeline of what happened. And out of this private investigation, I mean, you and I may have buried the leads here. It's very important for listeners to know they found zero evidence that any of the students, let alone all of them, that nobody chanted build the wall, which was supposedly the reason that Phillips came over toward them with the drum in the first place. And then the second wave of his explanation was he came over to try to head off a confrontation between the black Hebrew Israelites and the students. And when you see the whole video, there are students dancing around acting like teenagers while they do their school chants. And yes, the private investigators verified that several students, but not all, a few students, did a tomahawk chop gesture while they were dancing to Phillips' drumbeat. You know, you certainly would prefer they hadn't done that. But in terms of overt racist behavior and in terms of chanting anything offensive, the private investigators and the videos don't show any of that. Set the Wayback Machine online and go back and look at all the first reports. It's really amazing what we know now versus what we were told within the first 12 hours of that showdown.
You had mentioned this just a moment ago, but I do want, with about a minute, your thoughts on this. In all of the coverage, I have not seen much said about the black Hebrew Israelites. It is a intriguing name for a group. Their behavior there, by all accounts, was odd and repulsive.
Mm-hmm.
But
all I've seen is just mentions. I haven't seen further paragraphs about who they are, what they stand for, any of their spokespeople saying anything about this incident.
Well, in terms of their spokespersons, it's one thing, but there have been some fairly important mainstream media reports about this group and what they stand for. There's an interesting piece up right now at the Media Project, the group that I do a lot of work with at King's College and elsewhere, where one of the students had a family member who was active at one time in the Black Hebrew Israelites. And so this African-American reporter went to one of their meetings in New York. So, I mean, there have been some interesting things. Let's call them sidebars, not page one exposés, but informative sidebars about this group. But just remember that for the first 12 hours, we didn't know anything about what they did or what they said. And several people have observed the main time students stopped doing student chants and said, hey, you can't say that, that's totally out of line, was A, when the Black Hebrew Israelites verbally attacked an African-American student from Covington, and second, whenever the Black Hebrew Israelites made comments that were inflammatory about gays and lesbians. The tape shows a very different event than what we were told. And like I said, we're going to be unpacking this for a long time.
A general New York Times question for you. After President Trump's election, the publisher and the executive editor of the New York Times wrote, quote, after such an erratic and unpredictable election, there are inevitable questions. Did Donald Trump's sheer unconventionality lead us and other news outlets to underestimate his support among American voters? As we reflect on the momentous result and the months of reporting and polling that preceded it, we aim to rededicate ourselves to the fundamental mission of Times journalism, end quote. Have you noticed a change in the New York Times coverage since 2016?
I think the short answer to that is no. I think elite press in America is just as Trump obsessed as they were then, and if anything, it's gotten more so. And I think part of that is because of the economics of internet and digital journalism as well. This is not an era that's making me a happy camper when I open up a newspaper or sit down at my computer in the morning. Every once in a while, I have to just watch something funny just to try to cheer myself up. I would advise listeners to do the same.
Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He is founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thank you.
Glad to be here.
I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you next week. Thanks for listening to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly.
Crossroads is a joint production of GetReligion.org and Issues Etc.